22. Off the coast of Flamborough Head, Yorkshire, England, September 23, 1779, 5 p.m. The war has come for England. As the pale autumn sun sets over the Yorkshire coast, American Commodore John Paul Jones gathers his ship's officers on the quarterdeck to talk strategy. He is a wiry, clean-shaven man, standing 5'5" and wearing a blue uniform with gold epaulettes. On the main deck, the unmistakable sound of marine drummers beating to quarters echoes down into the ship's hold. Every member of the 300-man American and French crew races to battle stations in answer to this rat-a-tat command. Footnote: the most effective method of getting the attention of the entire crew at once was the use of the drum and fife. Armies and navies of the era used drums to broadcast signals. The most urgent was the continuous drum roll that signaled to arms, the call to form for battle. End footnote. A fight is imminent. Jones's aging flagship, the Bonhomme Richard, is 3 miles from land. She sails north, pushed by a light breeze. Footnote: Jones owed much of his success to the patronage of Benjamin Franklin in Paris. Franklin's pseudonymous writings, compiled in Poor Richard's Almanac, were translated into French as Les Maximes du Bonhomme Richard. Thus, when the French loaned the aging freighter, the Duc de Duras, to the Americans, Jones rechristened it in Franklin's honor upon taking command in February 1779. End footnote. The Continental Navy's mission has long been defensive in nature, focused on protecting America's shores. Jones takes a different approach, preferring to capture British vessels and their cargo in English waters, bringing the war home to the enemy. An English warship approaches from the opposite direction, closing the distance as she tacks into the wind. At first, she appears to be very much like the slow former freighter Richard, roughly 150 feet long and 40 feet at the beam. But as the English ship draws closer, it is clear she is a brand new vessel, gliding nimble and sleek through the waves. Jones will later describe the English ship, called Serapis, as a new ship of 44 guns built on their most approved construction with 2 complete batteries, one of them of 18-pounders. Jones refers to the 20 fierce cannon bored to fire 18-pound cannonballs that poke out of her lower gun ports, deliberately stationed on the bottom deck for the purpose of blasting the hulls of enemy ships when the fighting is at close quarters. The Bonhomme Richard has just 6 of these big guns. Yet while his vessel is slower, less modern, and outgunned, John Paul Jones knows he must win this battle if he is to fulfill his mission of capturing vessels from the British fleet. The Serapis is protecting a fleet of 40 British merchant vessels returning home from the Baltic Sea laden with cargo. Jones means to capture as many of these cargo ships as possible, thus depriving the English of naval stores vital to their war effort. In a month of raiding up and down the English coast, the Bonhomme Richard has claimed 16 such prizes. Jones has become notorious to the British Navy, a daring scoundrel who must be stopped. Aware of his notoriety, Jones ordered that the Richard raise the British flag in an attempt to conceal her true identity, but the masquerade fools no one. In the coastal town of Scarborough, a red pennant has been raised over the castle, warning ships at sea that there is a pirate in their midst. Local militia line the shore, hoping to repel any American vessel attempting to make landfall. This is more than mere precaution, for Jones has plundered the English countryside 2 times in the last year. Footnote: Jones's continued triumphs stands in marked contrast to that of the French and Spanish, whose attempt to invade England was called off in the summer of 1779 due to storms, poor communication, sickness, lack of supplies, and overall inept planning. End footnote. Defeating the Serapis, if that is possible, will require cunning, able seamanship, and a level of daring for which Jones has become well known. 32 and Scottish by birth, John Paul, his birth name, first went to sea at the age of 13, sailing with the British merchant fleet. During a 1770 voyage, he flogged a ship's carpenter so viciously that the man died. Upon being granted bail after a short time in a Scottish prison, Paul set sail for the West Indies. He successfully thwarted a mutiny by killing a sailor with his sword in self-defense, but feared the Admiralty courts would see it differently. He therefore fled to Fredericksburg, Virginia, where he took on the surname Jones in honor of local planter Willie Jones, whose family showed him great hospitality. Jones switched his alliance to the American cause at the same time. He has learned his trade well, advancing from ship's boy to the most infamous sailor in the Continental Navy. "If I have any capacity to render good and acceptable services to the common cause," Jones describes his motivations, sounding very much like George Washington, "no man will step forth with greater cheerfulness and alacrity than myself." Indeed, John Paul Jones has single-handedly brought the Revolutionary War to British shores, startling the citizens of this island nation into realizing that the American Rebellion has become a direct threat. The Serapis draws within 25 yards of the Richard. The time is now 6:30 p.m. On shore, spectators line the tall white cliffs, waiting expectantly for the flash of cannon fire that will signal the start of the engagement. The moon was rising, the weather being clear, the surface of the great deep being perfectly smooth, even as in a mill pond, an American midshipman will remember. Snipers hide in the topsails of both ships, muskets cocked. Jones orders his men first to kill the enemy sharpshooters and then to turn their guns on any man scurrying about the Serapis's main deck. If anything, the 40 American snipers have a little extra courage thanks to the double order of grog Jones has hoisted up to them. Footnote: grog is a mixture of rum and water named after its inventor, British Vice Admiral Edward Vernon, who was fond of wearing a suit made of grogram, a coarse fabric woven from silk, mohair, or wool, and went by the nickname Old Grog. The standard ration was a half pint of rum mixed with a quart of water per day. End footnote. "What ship is that?" Captain Richard Pearson of the Serapis cries out. The vessels are close. Pistol shot, as Jones will describe the range, and the British skipper's voice carries easily in the night. The sight of the British flag on the Bonham Richard makes Pearson reluctant to fire on her first. Pearson, 48, is every bit Jones's equal as a navigator, having fought in several major sea battles and having once piloted a ship through a hurricane. During one engagement, his ribs were shattered by a blast of grapeshot, but he refused to leave his post until the battle was won. But John Paul Jones does not know that. What he does know is that 20 brand-new 18-pounders are taking aim at his ship. British gun crews are famous for training relentlessly and striving to load and fire their weapons as quickly as possible. The Americans do not have that option because of a shortage of powder. As a result, the rebel gunners are far less proficient with their aging French cannon. Finally, a response comes from the Richard. "The Princess Royal." It is not Jones who does the talking, for his well-known Scottish brogue would give him away. Instead, it is the ship's master, Samuel Stacy, who replies. "Where from?" This time there is no answer. Stacy's voice has been no more effective than Jones's might have been, considering that his accent from Massachusetts sounds nothing like that of a British sailor. Pearson is insistent. "Answer immediately, or I shall be under the necessity of firing into you." Yet even as he yells across the smooth seas, Jones orders the British colors struck. The American flag is quickly raised in its place. It is one of many different designs in use by the Continental Army and Navy, but one and all on both vessels recognize the ensign as it instantly reveals the Bonham Richard's true colors. In the tops, the topsails, a nervous American sniper can't help himself. Knowing that battle is near, he squeezes off a round. Only then does Jones give his response. "We answered him by firing a whole broadside," Jones will later write to his friend and patron Benjamin Franklin. "The battle being thus begun was continued with unremitting fury." The Americans may have struck first, but within moments, two of the Richard's aging 18-pounders explode from misuse, killing the gun crews. The Serapis's own big guns soon destroy the rest of the Americans' 18-pounders, leaving the Bonham Richard with only a handful of lightweight cannon on the main deck. The moon is now completely risen, a full amber globe shining down on the mangled corpses splayed across the decks and dangling in the rigging, many of them old salts with years of experience at sea, but also among the dead are young boys between the ages of 8 and 16. Fire rages through the lower deck as salt water seeps in through the holes blasted by cannon. More than 100 prisoners captured in previous raids are locked below decks. Many now scream for their release as the Richard takes on water. Also below, men crowd into the office of the ship's surgeon, their faces blackened by burns and their maimed limbs soon to fall victim to the necessities of the bone saw. Scores more sailors and marines are already dead, decapitated by the hot metal of grape shot, ammunition similar to the canister shot used by the army. Bonham Richard's situation is grave. "Has your ship struck?" Captain Pearson calls out over the screams of the burned and maimed, wanting to know if Jones has lowered his colors in defeat. At last, the British will have their day with John Paul Jones. The Bonham Richard is barely able to maneuver. In fact, she will soon sink to the bottom of the North Sea. "Surrender be damned!" Jones yells back across the water. He is exhausted, having slept just 1 hour the night before, and quite aware he will not sleep at all this evening. "I have not yet begun to fight." Footnote. The precise wording of Jones's defiance is the subject of much debate. The authors defer to the U.S. Naval Academy's interpretation, which quotes these exact words. End footnote. The Serapis crashes hard into the Bonham Richard, fouling her bow into the thick rigging at the rear of the American ship. Thinking quickly, John Paul Jones races up a ladder to the poop deck to rope the two ships together. He succeeds, but the bond is tentative. Calling for a thicker rope, he is subjected to a barrage of swearing from shipsmaster Stacy, frustrated that the Richard is disabled and barely able to maneuver. "Mr. Stacy, it's no time to be swearing now," Jones says lightly, seeking to calm the veteran sailor. "You may be the next moment in eternity, but let us do our duty." Thus far in the battle, Captain Pearson has outfoxed Jones. He now orders his vessel to drop anchor, believing that if the Serapis stands fast, the disabled Richard will simply float away on the current, whereupon the British ship's big guns will fire at will and finish the job. Pearson has no reason to doubt that this bold gambit will succeed. The Serapis is 100 tons lighter, and thus more mobile. She has a protective copper bottom that allows her to sail faster. She also has the advantage in firepower. But Jones's ropes are holding. The Richard remains bound to the Serapis. If anything, the vessels now press closer together. Jones's only chance for victory is to immobilize the enemy ship and send his men onto her decks to engage in hand-to-hand fighting. The Americans throw grappling hooks at the Serapis, further tangling the vessels. The fighting becomes savage, to the death. In a scene of chaos, sailors leap onto enemy decks armed with swords, pistols, pikes, and grenades. The ensuing battle is terrifying and bloody, a free-for-all on the high seas. Some men drown. Some lose limbs to the blade of a cutlass. Point-blank pistol shots blow off men's faces. Jones orders his French marines to clamber up the Richard's three masts and into the topsails to join the ship's marksmen. One by one, those crew members of the Serapis unlucky enough to be roaming her exposed upper deck are raked by gunfire. Below decks, however, The Serapis' domination continues as her gunners unleash devastating broadsides with their big 18-pounders. Cannonballs enter one side of the Richard and exit the other until the American ship's gun decks are coated in a thick river of blood. On board the Serapis, the young boys known as powder monkeys race back and forth to the magazines, ensuring a constant supply of gunpowder. The gunners know to limit the amount of powder near the cannon for fear that a spark could ignite an explosion, but as the battle continues for hour after hour, the gun deck becomes littered with powder and cartridges. Footnote: in a normal day at sea, the gun deck is the hub of shipboard life, a place where sailors eat their meals and sling their hammocks for their 4 hours of sleep when not standing watch. The gun ports, just 6 feet above the waterline, are kept closed at all times. Their closure ensures complete darkness, but also keeps out the sea spray that chills the crew. The gun deck is a place for backgammon and, for those few seamen who are literate, reading. It smells worse than a barnyard, as the men will go unwashed throughout the entirety of their voyage. End footnote. Fire and water, the two terrors of a sailor's existence, soon begin to take their toll. The Richard is listing, and no amount of emergency hand-operated pumps can stop the incoming sea. The concern about fire is so great that fighting is halted for a time when the sails of both ships are ablaze, only to resume again when the flames are extinguished. Every moment of the action can be seen by the crowds lining the distant shoreline. More than 1,000 spectators cheer lustily after each cannon blast by the Serapis. They discern the two ships by the color of their topsides, black for the American ship and yellow for the Serapis. The fire of their cannon, especially the lower battery, which was entirely formed of 18-pounders, was incessant, Jones will write. My battery of 12-pounders, on which I had placed my chief dependence, was entirely silenced and abandoned. The Richard has just 3 cannon remaining, lightweight 9-pound deck guns. When the gunner in command suffers a head wound, Jones personally takes charge of the battery. He helps the gun crew maneuver the cannon from one side of the deck to the other. Remarkably, the Commodore is not wounded in any way. Refusing to go below for his own safety, as Pearson has done aboard the Serapis, Jones stands at the cannon, ready to fire. He orders his deck gunners to aim high, hoping not only to cut through the enemy's rigging, but also to kill the British sharpshooters in the opposing tops. Meanwhile, American and French marksmen continue to rain fire down on the Serapis' main deck. The Americans control the upper decks and the British below. Once Jones sees that the decks of the Serapis are clear, he orders those manning the cannon to switch their aim to its wooden mainmast. 3 feet thick and painted bright yellow, it holds the key to disabling the Serapis. Should the 150-foot column topple, the British ship's sails will also fall into the sea. At 10 p.m., 4 hours into the fight, American sailor William Hamilton lobs a series of grenades, hollow iron spheres filled with gunpowder ignited by a fuse, onto the Serapis. The first few grenades explode with little effect, but one lucky toss finds an open hatch. The grenade tumbles straight down to the gun deck, igniting the powder and cartridges surrounding the big guns. A series of explosions rock the Serapis. More than 100 pounds of gunpowder detonates. 20 sailors are killed instantly. Dozens more are maimed and severely burned. Humanity cannot but recoil from the prospect of such finished horror and lament that war should be capable of producing such fatal consequences, Jones will later write of the grisly scene. At 10:30 p.m., the decks of both ships are a scene of carnage, wreck, and ruin, in Jones's words. Captain Pearson strikes his colors. It is an act of utter humiliation, for Pearson had been so intent on not surrendering that he had personally nailed the flag to the rail so that it would become a permanent part of his ship. "Sir, I have struck!" Pearson yells over to Jones. Their ships are still locked together. From Pearson's position high on his quarterdeck, he is just 20 yards from Jones, who is still preparing to direct another cannon shot. John Paul Jones can clearly see the red British ensign still dangling limply from the taffrail, barely fluttering in the slight nighttime breeze. It has been shredded by the battle, but is still a symbol.
"If you have struck, haul down your ensign," the Commodore barks at Pearson.
Pearson rips down the flag, its fabric tearing loudly as it separates from the nails holding it in place. The Serapis is boarded.
"Have you struck, sir?"
a shocked British lieutenant asks Pearson. Pearson admits his surrender, then sends the officer below to order a ceasefire. Captain Pearson makes the surrender official by offering Jones his sword. Almost 300 men have died tonight. Both sides have suffered equally. The losses are all the more staggering for the sight of corpses littering both decks. The deaths are not neat bullet holes or single stab wounds, but appear to be the work of a butcher. Faces blackened by the soot of battle and the smoke of fire, arms and legs chopped away by canister. The bodies of these fallen men will soon be unceremoniously dumped over the side. Disturbing as the sight may be, there is a formality among opponents that must be observed. John Paul Jones ends the hostilities on a civil note, asking Captain Pearson to join him for a glass of wine in what remains of his cabin. Footnote: Captain Pearson will be taken as a prisoner of war. Initially gracious, he will become angry and restive during his captivity. Upon his return to England months after the battle, he will be hailed as a hero for preventing the loss of the convoy and will eventually be knighted. End footnote. The danger is not past, however. The Bonham Richard bobs listlessly just off the English coast, easy pickings for other British warships. The crowds on the shore know that the Serapis has lost the battle, so it is only a matter of time before Jones is confronted by another British vessel. Jones desperately tries to save the Richard, but she begins to sink lower and lower into the North Sea. Her gun ports are soon breached by the waves. Cutting the ropes, Jones reluctantly orders all hands transferred to the Serapis, prisoners included. She no longer has a mast, so as the Richard finally settles below the waves, John Paul Jones orders his crew to rig makeshift sails, and the Serapis sets sail. For 10 long days, she travels east, evading British patrols. Finally, Jones maneuvers her toward the safety of the Dutch port of Texel. Benjamin Franklin responds to a letter from John Paul Jones written upon the Commodore's arriving safely in Texel. "For some days," Franklin writes on October 10, 1779, "scarce anything was talked of at Paris and Versailles but your cool conduct and persevering bravery during that terrible conflict." In London, George III has no public response to the embarrassment John Paul Jones has caused Great Britain. But in Parliament, the anti-war voices grow more vocal and numerous by the day.
The King has no intention of losing the war to the Americans.
In fact, he and his war council are set to release a new weapon, but this one is not made of steel. It is a human being named Banastre Tarleton.